Anwar per se. You know, you'll hear the soundbite from the media that Anwar is not in the GOP platform, but we believe it is.
Alaska delegates to the GOP convention fight for drilling in Anwar. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 28th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a rare bear mauling in Gates of the Arctic National Park.
She has significant injuries, but they are not life-threatening.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, a proud supporter of cultural activities that enrich the lives of all Alaskans. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
The Democratic National Convention wraps up tonight in Denver with a speech from presidential nominee Barack Obama. In the meantime, Republican delegates are busy crafting their party's platform for their convention next week in St. Paul, Minnesota. Alaskans are helping in that effort, but failed to insert a mention of support for drilling in Anwar in the 20,000-word document. Republican presidential nominee John McCain has long been an opponent of Anwar drilling. David Boyle is an Anchorage resident and a McCain delegate who helped write the party platform this week. He tried to convince fellow delegates Anwar should be included.
It was the longest discussion of any topic in the platform committee in like 24 hours of sessions. And I thought we made some progress. We got the best we could. We got several bites out of the apple, so to speak. And Anwar per se, you know, you'll hear the soundbite from the media that Anwar is not in the GOP platform. But we believe it is, and I can explain that in a few more words.
How close was it to passing at all?
It was very close. It was very close, and the majority of the delegates there, as a matter of fact, I would say probably close to 98% of them favored our position. However, we needed to reach a compromise such that we didn't, let's say, put the acronym Anwar in the platform per se. So we compromised, and which was agreeable to everyone there. And the compromise, if I can just read a little bit to you, what really is going to be in the platform, and which does support drilling in Anwar because it does not exclude it. We support accelerated exploration, drilling, and development in America, from new oil fields off the nation's coast to onshore fields, such as those in Montana, North Dakota, and Alaska.
Why do you think the stronger language or just the mention of Anwar failed? You're sort of getting at it with this more ambiguous language anyway. Why not put Anwar in there?
We have to. We had to compromise somewhat with the McCain campaign, and we did a lot of education here. We brought 400 folders with us to hand out at the Republican convention, informing and educating our fellow delegates on drilling in the coastal plain of Anwar. Many of them at this platform committee, there were 110 delegates. Many of those folks were just amazed to learn the actual facts about the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So we really reaped a bonus there because we feel these folks now can go back to their respective states and territories and educate the electorate back there and put the true story out to the entire country. So that was one of our goals. We achieved that goal.
Mr. Boyle, does your support for opening Anwar to drilling conflict at all with your support for John McCain?
No, it doesn't. Matter of fact, I was the one that introduced an amendment to support drilling for oil in the Anwar, and the issue we just discussed, the 30-minute discussion on it, and I led it off by, I'm a very strong supporter for John McCain, and I like him. You know, I love my country, and that's what this is all about.
Do you think the other Alaska delegates will eventually throw their support behind John McCain at the convention?
Yes, I have no fears. I think we will all come together, particularly in the Alaska delegation, and support Senator McCain for president.
David Boyle is a delegate to the Republican National Convention. It starts Monday in St. Paul, Minnesota. Mark Begich says Alaska needs a new approach in dealing with new leadership in Washington, D.C. if the state plans to continue receiving federal assistance for meeting local needs. The Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate in this fall's election said it's important to present any state need as a partnership, not to count solely on federal gifts to solve problems. He said the entire country will feel the effects of a $10 trillion national debt, and federal assistance will be difficult for anyone to obtain.
Those days of just giving some money are slim and far and few. What I think is more advantageous to us is show how we're going to partner. And I think all across the country that's going to be happening. It's a different style.
In Begich's view, a partnership is a way of offering state financial participation in a project as well as including other states and communities with similar needs into national issues. As an example, he says the federal government has the obligation to deal with the nation's energy transmission needs. He says delivering energy from a wind farm or a solar array is also a major need for Alaska.
So the idea is to take an Alaskan idea, make it a national concept, so you get a lot more friends, meaning senators and congressmen, that say, we're going to do this way. Because if you just say, well, we're going to do an earmark and do a little money for Angoon or Juneau, that doesn't solve the energy issue. What that does is solve a moment in time. This is a national security issue. It's a national economic issue. And we should look at it from a national perspective. And there is no better state that can do this than Alaska.
Begich is running against Senator Ted Stevens, whose staff did not reply to a request for a response. In the past, Stevens has promoted a mix of traditional energy sources with renewable energy. A woman is being treated at a hospital in Fairbanks after being mauled by a grizzly bear early this morning in Gates of the Arctic National Park. The attack happened in an isolated area about 30 miles west of Anaktuvik Pass. John Quinley is a spokesman for the National Park Service in Anchorage. He says a group of seven people were camped at the site.
The bear had first broken into their food tent and torn up some water bottles, but had not gotten any food, and then moved over to her tent where she was mauled. She has significant injuries, but they are not life-threatening.
The National Park Service isn't releasing the woman's name and doesn't yet know where she's from. She was flown by Coyote Air to Coldfoot this morning and then transferred to Fairbanks this afternoon. The Park Service hasn't had a chance to talk with the victim or any members of her group. Quinley says the area where they were camped is very remote and receives very little use each year.
The bear was apparently believed to be an adolescent grizzly bear, and it... After the attack, other people in the group came and chased the bear off with a mix of bear spray and making noise, and the bear did not return after that.
Quinley says attacks in Gates of the Arctic are very rare.
About 3 years ago, along the Alatna River, which is to the south of where this took place, there was a black bear that was very aggressive to people who were floating and camping along the river. He did not make contact with anyone, but came at groups repeatedly. And then back in 1996, there was a fatality, a bear-caused fatality in Gates of the Arctic. But bear incidents are very rare in the park.
As a precaution, the National Park Service has temporarily closed the area to overnight camping. A map of the closed section is posted on the park's website. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Pribilof Aleuts celebrate their freedom from federal control.
They had to ask permission to leave the island. They had to ask permission to travel even to the Aleutian chain to visit relatives.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The Republican primary race between Don Young and Sean Parnell for Alaska's U.S. House seat isn't the only contest that's too close to call. The Democratic nomination for State House District 36 is also neck and neck. With 14 of 14 precincts reporting, candidates Andy Lundquist and Dave Kaplan are now only 7 votes apart. Lundquist leads with 504 votes to Kaplan's 497. Both Kaplan and Lundquist were amazed at the small margin.
We're down to 7 votes? Man, that's close. Well, we'll just have to let the process play out. We'll just see what happens.
Isn't that something? It's unbelievable how close it is.
There are still an unknown number of absentee and question ballots outstanding, according to the Alaska Division of Elections. The state has up to 15 days after the election to count all the ballots, but they're shooting to have that done by September 5th. The election will be certified on or about September 17th. After that date, a defeated candidate or 10 voters registered in District 36 can request a recount. If the difference between the candidates is less than 0.5%, the $2,000 fee for a recount is waived. Currently, Lundquist and Kaplan are 0.7% apart. Kaplan says the sooner the votes are tallied, the better, so that the winner can get to work at campaigning against his Republican rival.
I don't like a recount. Let's get it done. You know, the voters, our constituents need to have, you know, a candidate right now. So I would like to see this go over quickly, you know, once we get the numbers.
Lundquist is taking a wait-and-see approach to the drawn-out process.
Well, I'm not real concerned about it. I mean, if that's what the rules are, I mean, I'm confident. I'm real happy that people have supported me up to this point, and I look forward to the next stage of this great adventure.
If the two candidates are tied after all the absentee and question ballots are counted, the state will conduct an automatic recount. If they are still tied after that, the winner will be determined by a coin flip. The eventual winner will face Alan Osterman, who ran unopposed in the closed Republican primary. Voters in Dillingham are still reeling from the defeat of Proposition 4, which would have made it difficult to develop the proposed Pebble Mine. Many people in the region feel the mine will threaten the area's rich salmon fishery. Eileen Good of member station KDLG has more.
No one KDLG spoke to was happy with the decision that voters made statewide, with a few questioning the values of their fellow Alaskans.
What's the rest of Alaska going to do without salmon? That's all I got to say. We've survived off of salmon for generations and generations.
No, I guess we're going to suffer here in the bay, but other people might be good about it. But see, those clean water, there might not be clean water to worry about in other places, but there's clean water here to worry about. So there's not enough people to vote around here to, you know, like teeter-totter the vote.
Others had questions for elected officials, specifically Governor Sarah Palin, and her decision to weigh in on the issue a week outside of the primary election.
Well, I thought it was really a shame that the governor came out and really basically told a bunch of her supporters how to vote. I think that she should let the process work. I think she got involved in the politics of Ballot 4.
Still, not everything about the outcomes of Ballot Measure 4 were disappointing. District 37 Representative Bryce Edmond said he was pleased to see high local voter turnout, and that even in failure, there are some interesting things to note about the results.
Well, it didn't pass on a statewide basis, but if you break it down and look at the election districts across the state, Ballot Measure 4 actually passed all the major fishing communities in Alaska. Cordova, Sitka, Petersburg, Kodiak, Dillingham, Unalaska, Homer, Sandpoint, Bethel, if you count that as a fishing community, and it passed all these communities, and by varying degrees, some of the votes were close, some were by pretty good margins. In my view, that's really a strong statement that the fishing community came out in support of clean water, and that, you know, really this is a battle that's just beginning.
Other voters, who declined to speak on air, said that though they didn't like the outcome of yesterday's vote, they were cheered that other fishing communities seemed to vote for the ballot measure. They also said they were basically unsurprised with the general outcome. In Dillingham, I'm Eileen Good.
The state and other property owners affected by the 2006 Parks Highway wildfire will receive compensation. The state announced the $400,000 settlement with an insurance company yesterday. The company, which represents Anderson area resident Thad Kalwitz, who accidentally started the blaze, will pay the state $90,000. The rest of the money will be divided among a local native corporation and other private property owners. The fire burned 130,000 acres, 3 homes, and a number of outbuildings during June of 2006. 2006. Lynn Wilcock with the Alaska Division of Forestry says the fire's start was a clear case of negligence.
Remnants of a burn barrel were dumped onto a vegetated area that caught the vegetation on fire, which eventually moved into the surrounding woods. And homeowners are responsible for the fires that they start on their land, and if those fires escape, there are consequences to those types of actions.
Wilcock says it's not uncommon for the state to go after compensation for wildfire damage and suppression costs.
Most cases where we can determine through an investigation that it was, in fact, someone's responsibility for starting a fire, we will attempt to recover the damages to the state. Of course, those costs will vary depending on how large the fire gets and how much the state has to expend to suppress the fire. But we are trying to do that on a regular basis when, in fact, it is started by a human negligent act.
The state attempted to pursue criminal prosecution for the park's highway fire, but the district attorney's office found no evidence of recklessness. State Forestry spent $2.9 million battling the blaze. The state can legally seek double that amount from responsible parties, but in this case, the individual did not have the ability to cover such a huge bill. Division of Forestry statistics show that 85% of the wildfires it responds to are human-caused.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Dungeness crabbers had a good summer in southeast Alaska. The season in most of southeast ran from mid-June to mid-August. Fish and Game's assistant management biologist Carla Bush says the total catch was above average again this year at nearly 3.7 million pounds.
And that's with 195 permit holders reporting landings. Harvest from the previous 2007 summer season was just under 3.6 million pounds, and that was by 176 permit holders. So it was very similar to last year, and maybe even roughly 100,000 pounds or so more landed this summer as compared to last summer.
Crab averaged $2.25 a pound on the dock, about 14 cents more than last summer. This year's catch was worth a total of $8.3 million, according to Bush. That compares to $7.6 million for last summer.
So prices were up this summer and harvest was up a bit.
Last year's price was up about 75 cents from the year before. Typically, 80% of the southeast Dungy catch comes in the summer fishery, with another 20% coming in during the two-month fall season. Recent data suggests that while Japan and other Asian markets continue to lead the way for importing Alaska seafood, the rest of the world is quickly catching up, especially the countries that make up the European Union. The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is trying to take advantage of Europeans' interest in Alaska fish by bringing journalists from the region to the state. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
Christian Botter is a German television journalist based in Munich. He's working on a documentary about Alaska's fishing industry that will air on German TV.
And it's mostly going to be films where I accompany fishermen going out, going for halibut, longlining, for example, or a lot of salmon.
Asmi set it up so that Botter and his cameraman could spend the night on a salmon troller outside Sitka. They've also visited Juneau and now Kodiak. On Saturday, they took a float plane to the Kodiak Regional Aquaculture Association's Katoy Bay Hatchery on Afognak Island. Botter says he's been impressed by Alaska's natural beauty, which he calls the Wild Wild North.
It's not like in the lower 48 in many regions or in Europe where everything is really urbanized, you know. I mean, we went to this hatchery today, and it's a whole bunch of buildings and people working there, and right in front of it is a bunch of bears hunting for salmon. So this is really, a wild state, I guess.
Botter says Germans and Europeans in general are concerned about overfishing and react favorably to buzzwords like sustainability and wild. According to ASME's website, between 2000 and 2006, the percentage of Alaska's seafood exported to Europe increased from 11% of all exports to 23%. But even though Alaska seafood is making inroads in European markets, Botter says it's still a tough sell.
Yeah, that's why farmed fish from Scandinavia is so popular, because it's really, really cheap. Mm-hmm. I think 20 years ago, it wasn't normal to eat salmon. you know, like every day, whatever. And now it's become so cheap, it's one of the cheapest fish on the desk. So it would be people looking for special products that buy the Alaskan wild-caught salmon.
Cornelius Stolze is a freelance journalist from Hamburg with a background in biology. She writes mainly on the topics of the environment and sustainability, but as a consumer, she admits that in the past she hasn't paid much attention to where her fish comes from.
I wouldn't have been able to tell the difference from farmlex, but not from Norwegian, Scottish, and I wouldn't know that Alaska has a specific regulation system. It was just a name, like a brand, but I couldn't tell what is behind the brand. And I think this is the biggest change that has happened during this travel.
She says in Europe, with so many countries competing for limited resources, there's no unified fishery management. So getting to witness Alaska's system up close has been an eye-opener.
Well, people told us that they do fight a lot about how people are allowed to go to different places and they have to buy permits and everything. Everything's very strongly regulated, strictly regulated, but still they seem to be united in the goal. And that's very nice to see.
This isn't the first time ASME has brought foreign journalists to witness Alaska's fishing industry. Last year, a group from France toured southeast Alaska. In 2006, a group from China visited the state on a trip that included a stop in Kodiak. In Kodiak, I'm Casey Kelly.
From the late 1700s until 1983, the Aleut people of the Pribilof Islands were in servitude to the fur seal business. First, Russia controlled the trade, and after the sale of Alaska to the U.S., the Aleuts were under the thumb of the federal government. Their transition to independence was not easy, but 25 years after they were freed from fur seal industry bondage, the 450 residents of St. Paul Island are celebrating and taking a week to relive various aspects of Aleut history. Aquilina Lestenkoff is the director of the Tribal Culture Department. She says after the North Pacific Fur Seal Treaty of 1911 was signed, there were strict federal controls on every aspect of life for the Aleuts in the early 1900s.
In 1911, because the United States government had to answer to other countries that were party to the Fur Seal Treaty, everything on these islands had to be accounted for. Every nut, screw, bolt, piece of cloth, every fur. And so from that point on, the Pribilof Aleut people, in a sense, served, as we call, a century of servitude.
How much control did Aleut people have over their lives during this period? What happened if they wanted to leave the island or if others wanted to come to the island?
Well, I think our people didn't have a whole lot of control over what they did. They had to ask permission to leave the island. They had to ask permission to travel even to the Aleutian chain to visit relatives. And this was up into the 1960s that our people had to ask for permission to leave. In regards to people having to answer to the federal government regarding what they did, even clothing was issued to people. The homes belonged to the United States government. So it was sort of like a company town.
And Aquilina, when you think of the research that you've done about your own history, your people's history there in the islands, what have you come across that really gives an example that maybe really stood out to you as an illustration of how stringent the control was that the federal government had at that time?
I have everything from my dad telling his stories of the work that he had to do and sometimes how he wanted to rebel. But I also have a simple story of my grandmother who was so happy to be issued a muffin tin. Every house in the village got a muffin tin, and she was so happy because she was going to make muffins for her family. And the next day, the representative of the federal government came back and collected all the muffin tins because what they were supposed to be used for was to freeze fox food as fox bait for fox trapping. So that one is just, you know, I look at my grandmother who, for one thing, couldn't buy a muffin tin. It had to be issued to her, and then it was taken away. We hope that by bringing this to light, people will see what an important role the Pribilofs chapter is in the history of the United States.
How difficult was it in the 80s when that transition happened and suddenly your people were in charge of themselves exclusively? How difficult was it economically?
I think a lot of the energy went to deciding who was going to be in charge of what. We had a municipal government, we had a tribal government, and we had a village corporation. In addition to that, we were planning a harbor. And so all of this kept people busy, and I think we kept our heads above water. It wasn't smooth. It wasn't easy. But I think we did pretty good.
And the celebration starts this week. What do you have planned?
What we decided was that what we really needed to do was to celebrate our whole history. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go way back to prior to the Russians, quote-unquote, discovering the Pribilof Islands. We're going to celebrate one of our own people, Igadaga, who solely in a single-hatch kayak went from the Aleutian Islands to the Pribilofs. And other than the commemorative paddle, we're going to commemorate the evacuation of our people to Thunder Bay during World War II. This will start with a commemorative softball game. When the people were notified that they were to be evacuated, they were right in the middle of a baseball game in our nearly 100-year-old baseball field. And so we'll start there. And Saturday afternoon, the church bells will toll. And as a community, we will walk to a dock on the east side of the village and have a prayer commemorating that walk that our people took in 1942 to board the USAT Delaroff. And one of the things that we forget is when our people left, they had, you know, like one piece of luggage. And when they boarded that ship and looked back, they never knew if they were going to come back again.
Aquilina Lestenkoff is the director of the Aleut Culture Department on St. Paul Island. She says documentary films, dance exhibitions, and other activities will take place throughout their independence celebration. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett and Casey Kelly in Kodiak, Eileen Good in Dillingham, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by BP, focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas online. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.